is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also simulcast on KEPW.org. All right, so continuing on with the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, this is a lecture on urban farming and urban forestry. So, gives me a chance, my sustainability experience. There's a book called A Timeless Way of Building. And what he talks about, and this is my own observation, in addition to what he talks about in this book, one of the reasons it's very important to have open space in the city for many reasons, but one of the reasons that I've discovered is there's a thing in psychiatry, and psychiatry, you know, is limited to how powerful psychiatry is. But anyway, it's called transference. There's a point where during child development, and I'm not an expert on child development, there's a point in a child's development where he or she needs to go explore away from their mother, but then have a way of coming back to their mother when something goes wrong. So, and this is how kids learn confidence. And you can trace, there's a book called The Batterer, that this is how people become batterers and things like that, is because they don't have confidence in themselves. And so I'm going astray from sustainability, but this is why how critical architecture is in our society and city planning. It actually develops your personality. So the example I have is, for instance, in LA, in the Timeless Way of Building, they have neighborhoods. In Europe, they have neighborhoods for years, even in before Roman times. And the neighborhood, everyone knew everyone in the neighborhood, and you couldn't easily get in and out of the neighborhood without, they didn't have a Roman grid. They had crooked streets and stuff that you had, and dead-end streets. And it was difficult to get in and out, and everyone knew. So it was difficult for an outsider to come in and do damage. It would be difficult for them to do. So, and everyone knew everyone in the neighborhood. So an extension of that is my own experience is growing up in L.A., the kids over on Stone Canyon had a creek in their backyard, so all the houses had a common area in the backyard. So if someone were to come in that area, you would probably know about it. And the point I'm trying to make is, so now these kids could have some autonomy and play, and yet have a safe area to play, but there's some adventure going on. And there's another example. There's a book that compares, among other things, it compares Disneyland to Coney Island. And I've never been to Coney Island, but what the book was saying is that there's some danger involved in Coney Island, that where you can get, there's places that you can get away from your parents and have some autonomy. And again, so you can have a little bit of an adventure, but yet still have some safety there. Whereas Disneyland, everything is, you know, so scripted and sterile that there's nothing. I mean, you can go on the Monsanto ride and make out, I guess, but other than that, you're pretty much supervised at Disneyland. So the point that I'm trying to make is there's this psychological concept called transference, where you need to have a little bit of adventure and risk, and you know, it's like a kid doesn't have to put his hand in the fire to learn not to put your hand in the fire, but that's the example. You have to take a little risk to learn self-confidence and confidence in yourself that you can get yourself out of a jam. And yet, you know, while you're a child, there's still people around you that can help you. So that's what these. So this is how critical city planning and open space and city farming and this type of stuff is in sustainability. All right, so this is the PILC conference, available on YouTube. I didn't put the questions on there, so it's available on YouTube now, the rest that I didn't get. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends. City farming and city forestry. Urban farming and urban forestry. Coming up here on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, simulcast on KPW.org. Support independent media.
First is Harper Keeler, who is the director of Urban Farm Program, of the Urban Farm Program within the Landscape Architecture Department at U of O. He got his undergraduate degree in landscape architecture from U of O in 95 and has been with the program since 92. He started teaching in 2001 and has been involved and has been the director since 2008. In addition to running the farm, he's on the Faculty Advisory Council of the U of O Food Studies Program. He got his master's in landscape architecture in 2011, focusing on experimental place-based education within the pedagogy of landscape architecture. He has extensive experience working with urban farm-related programs throughout our local agrarian community. Then we have Rick. He is a land planner at Senior Aviation. He got his bachelor's degree in psychology and physics from UC Riverside in 77, and then master's in urban regional planning from Cal State Polytechnic University at Pomona in 92. He has worked in aviation community planning as well as urban planning and design. His presentation is going to focus mostly on urban ecology. And then Eric Burke is an ISA certified arborist and also the director of Friends of Trees in Eugene. He received his bachelor's degree from U of O in anthropology in 94 and master's in applied anthropology from Oregon State, where he focused on building locally adapted food systems in the Maris River watershed area. He's worked for Friends of Trees for the past 9 years, which is a nonprofit organization started in Portland in 89. They organize neighborhood tree planting events to help our urban canopy.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak, and looking forward to this. So I'm gonna start with this picture right here, and you might be asking, where are we going? I'm gonna throw out a bunch of slides that are gonna look at historical cross-cultural representations of what people felt that was important, that is directly tied to architecture, landscape architecture, and agriculture. And it's gonna go pretty quick. I hope no one gets seasick. But the idea is that over time, people have expressed what they think is important through the art that they do, through the food they eat, and through the places they make that kind of intersects those things. And then I'm gonna talk a little bit about the Urban Farm Program. But the Taj Mahal is what you can do if you're the richest guy and you wanna build something for your girlfriend, right? It's one of the most famous buildings in the country, in the world. But if you zoom out a little bit, the Taj Mahal, the plan for the Taj Mahal is a very classic orchard food producing thing. You can see in the the bird's eye shot of the plan that most of the landscape is actually very stylized four-court garden, very famous agricultural shape. If you go to Spain of the Moors in the 12th century, the very famous courtyard of the oranges, that this is the highest expression of art within the epicenter of power and of spirit, and they filled it with irrigation and orange trees. If you travel to Renaissance Italy, perhaps the most famous garden is something called Villa d'Este. You can see on the left the stylized parterre, the French would call parterre, which was the stylization of a kitchen garden. But going from right to left, you go through the forest, down into landscape rooms, down into the garden. And I'm just gonna show a few quick pictures of this. And it's a series of rooms that goes down to the garden you can see in the background. Here's another picture of it looking back up the hill of Villa d'Este. And you might ask, what does this have to do with food and agriculture? Well, what you did is they would bring the food down from the kitchens above, and they would put them in little boats and they would float them down this table. It was a sushi bar, basically. This is Villa d'Este, one of the most famous, most powerful gardens of its time. But again, just like the Taj Mahal, if you look at it in the original, in the whole design, the landscape of the space is deeply ingrained into an agricultural endeavor also, with the, you know, the fruit trees and the woodlots and separate gardens sprinkled about throughout. In the 1600s, perhaps the most famous painter in the world was Claude Lorrain, and these were the most stylistic depictions of what was important to the people of the time. And if you know about Renaissance art, you know about the darkness in the woods and what that means, and the light is the good and the glory. But what really distinguishes Claude's work is the incorporation of these pastoral images, which of course are agricultural. Here's another one, and that really shows off the sunset and the distance, which is the glory of God, I guess, in that context. And I was struck by this. There was something about this. I came across another image recently. I don't know if McDonald's is going with that with their breakfast menu, but there's sort of, there should be a soundtrack that's like, you know. Anyway, in Japan, the reverence that people have for their agriculture and their working together and the social cohesion that brings is really illustrated in the rice painting they do. Now, that's not rice that's been painted. That's rice that is planted specifically for the color. And when it grows, it creates these incredible images, and it's rice. And they're wacky. I think this is one of the cooler things you can see. Really, really interesting. And why this is important in this context is this is what that village does every year as part of their agricultural tradition. If here's a shot, everybody comes out and you're given your packages of rice with your little, you know, spots, and you have to plant it exactly right. And it grows, they flood it, and then it starts to grow. You can see it here, and then finishes. And this is fantastic. I just think this is fantastic. And then in the fall, they do it with the same amount of reverence in the harvest, right? So this is an image of how they're harvesting the rice, and they're hanging it or stacking it to dry in an equally artistic and reverential way. And everybody comes out. So you get the idea. There's something about togetherness, about cohesion based on agriculture that's unmistakable. And, you know, if we move this forward to our time, I think we can get back to this, and we'll get into that in a little bit. You know, the landscape of Wales is distinct in its manipulation to the natural systems and how that connects with the agriculture. You can see the windrows that they're so famous for. And you would recognize this in Amish country, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You know, the landscape is that of agriculture, right? And here's an image that I wanted to show when you get more urban, but what you're looking at is a bomb crater during the Blitz in London during the war, World War II. And what these people have done is they've filled in the bomb crater with soil so that they can garden in the middle of the street. Now, we're going to talk about street trees and liability and those things, but I don't think they went to a committee for this. They just did it. And it shows a resilience that's remarkable. Just a couple more. This is a landscape, obviously, with Central Park West and the park, and that kind of juxtaposition of spaces. If we had lots of time, we could talk about the agricultural history of Central Park that Olmsted was really in touch with when he designed it. But it just really shows what you can do in an urban setting. Now, in our case, this is our food landscape, unfortunately. And we've all recognized this. And I think that there's probably something in between, right? Getting toward that end, this is a shot I took recently of a landscape, food landscape in Portland, where they're reclaiming the parking lot for the food trucks And it's, although this isn't trees per se, it is definitely food and infrastructure interacting or being juxtaposed. This one's a bit scarier, and this is the downside of agriculture and space and creation with, I guess, you know, natural systems. But what, I mean, what looks like an abstract expressionist painting, this is a satellite shot of the manure lagoons that accompany the feedlots that give us the meat we eat. Here's another one. And if you sort of squint, it's actually quite sublime. But this is scary. And this is the legacy of the separating our food from ourselves and putting it somewhere else. You can see at the bottom, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but at the bottom of the, you know, the neighboring field, you can see the bacterial evidence that is leaching outside of that lagoon. And it's all about cows, right? So this is the landscape of food that is separated from our urban fabric and where we live, right? We've seen these things. Finally, one more of those is that it goes beyond the limits of that feedlot and the hundreds of acres there. This is the watershed of North America mostly. And not only have we've depleted the aquifers underneath it, but the blue and yellow you see towards the bottom is the relative condition of the Gulf of Mexico. This is the dead zone. So 700 years of fertilizer and pesticide runoff and leaching has created algae blooms in the Gulf of Mexico that are the size of New Jersey, right? So we're killing the oceans with that separation and industrialization of food, okay? That's all sad. So I don't like ending with a sad one on that section, because this is a little better. This is my friend Santiago Danger Slosberry. Danger actually is his middle name. But his first day after being born, he's having a nap at the urban farm in a cabbage. He's an exceptional young kid these days. And my friend Dominic, who found a porcini in the woods. That's a little hope for these times. So, and then I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the urban farm and the program that I teach and that I've been a part of for a long time. So if we're talking about growing food in the Willamette Valley, you got to start somewhere, and you might as well start with the Missoula floods that happened about 15,000 years ago. And you can see up, there was an ice dam up in what would be Idaho, Montana, these, you know, now, that broke, causing the largest geological event that we can really track. What we're talking about is a massive flood that created the Columbia River Gorge and filled the Willamette Valley with water. And we're at the very tip, southern tip, Eugene right here, I'm sitting right here. And here's an artist version of that. But what that does, though, is that when you flood and recede and flood and recede, what's left behind is the silty loam that we call the Willamette Valley. And here's a shot of that landscape. It's beautiful. That's our river. I think a lot of that yellow is grass seed, so I'm not sure we're using it as great as we could be using it. But there's great evidence of bringing back the diversity of the agriculture in the Willamette Valley. And I just want to take 2 seconds to, if we're talking about the Willamette Valley and our history and agriculture, it's probably prudent to mention that we're not the first ones here. When we got here, there was a different type of agriculture that happened, and we should always remember the Kayapuya people that were here first and the many nations that were here first. That's a cultural thing. I'm gonna talk more about the European-based agriculture from here on, but I just wanted to bring that up. So here we are in 1930, old Hayward Field at the University of Oregon is down here, where, you know, you can see the circle. And what would be Autzen Stadium, football stadium, is in the section just north of the river. But, you know, it's easy to see the agricultural evidence and domination of the land use in the 30s. You also see the ribbon that runs along between, that would be Route 99 or Franklin Boulevard and the river. And that's the mill race that was dug with horses in the 1800s to power the textile mills, and then eventually the breweries that were in that area of Eugene, even before Eugene was Eugene. So agriculture has been there as long as Europeans have. Here's a zoom in version of that. And that is the setting for where the urban farm is, and for the north, what we call North Campus at the University of Oregon. And in the 70s, this silly looking fellow showed up. His name is Richard Britz. And Britz was a sort of visionary architect, landscape architect. Here's another picture of him. And what Britz did was he came up with a concept called the Edible City. And the Edible City was a series of design studios that looked at what can we do to make the places we live more productive? And so they took a city block, basic city block, and realized there's a lot of space in between. There's alleyways that don't have the issues of you know, liability and things like that. There's lots of potential. And they started doing drawings and brainstorming about how they could turn these into productive landscapes. And this one, you see the shared area in the center of the block has now been used collectively as food production. And why not amp it up? Let's plant trees all around. Let's retrofit houses to be passive solar. And perhaps let's buy one of the houses and make it a barn where we can have a commercial kitchen and those kind of things. Here's a color version. And you'll notice that all of a sudden, the cottage industry and the things we can do on the site allows a lot of people to work there. So maybe we don't need every road that goes between every block. And in this case, we can start planting fruit trees and places for children to play instead of where the cars had to be. And then they said, well, that's all good. Let's try it. So they created the urban farm. This would have been at the late 70s. And here's a drawing of the first things that they did. And Britz was really into systems. So irrigation and compost and animals on site and the things that we now see in our neighborhoods in Eugene, what we would call urban agriculture, I guess, and how they all go together, right? And, you know, I'd be happy anyone ever wants to talk in more detail about the things we're, you know, how those systems work, I'm happy to. But in the early 80s, a woman named Ann Bettman came along and she said, this should be a pedagogical example. Let's teach this stuff. And she created the urban farm as a program. And so I'm going to run just through a few of the things that we look at real quick. But this is the farm on the campus of the University of Oregon. And I love the drone shots. It really gives an idea of what's going on. This is the summertime. You can see the class, a class group meeting talking about what they would be doing. There's another shot, right? And it's kind of nestled in. It's even more so now that the Knight Science Center is would be on the right of that screen, just across the mill race. But this is kind of the scale of what we do, and it's biointensive, you know, hands-on education for students. Let's learn how to grow food. Let's learn how to plant things. This would be early spring. Let's work together. What people can do if they all get together, I'm going to, post-COVID, we're going to do this again. Let's work in greenhouses and think about the seasons. And this is a group from the local community college. Let's grow food these are plant starts for Huerto de la Familia, which is our local nonprofit that works with the Latinx community to do garden stuff. Let's have teachers come. So these are all garden educators that have come to the farm to learn about how to teach this to the kids. Let's get the kids. So these are my freshmen I had for our first year students last year, many of which never had a tool in their hand. Let's go into the neighborhoods And if we do that, we can tear up lawns and put in gardens, right? And then finally, let's eat together. So this is setting up the harvest. Every class, students get to take home what they grew, and that's very powerful. This year with COVID, we didn't have the students, so we had, this is food for one day delivery to the food pantry that feeds the students. And it's pretty she food pantry. They're getting basil, they're getting sweet corn. It was outstanding. We had 800 students a week. Let's celebrate the seasons. This is May Day. This is apples in the fall. Perhaps let's fall in love. These folks met themselves at the farm and now they're married and teachers and farmers. Let's learn stuff. This student just had to have her picture taken there. And that's what I got. And I only used local children. Sorry I went over, but that's what I have.
Maybe I'm supposed to start. I'm not sure. Is that okay?
Go ahead. Thanks, Harper.
That was a lot of fun, Harper. I really enjoyed that. And a lot of my Green City students in the Planning Public Policy and Management School take your course. And I think they most often even want to write a paper on urban farming and their experience with community gardens and so on. So it's good to finally meet you. And I hope we get a little bit of time to talk during this session about some of the things we touched on earlier. We seem to have, you, Eric, and I seem to have some commonalities in our approach to greening cities, if you will. So I need to apologize immediately because I posted online a LinkedIn announcement for this session starting at 1:30. So there were over 700 views of that post, and of the two or three people that are going to attend, they're going to attend right when Eric's going, and in conclusion. So it's a good thing that Beck is going to record this, and I'll do a follow-up post that they can get a recorded version of this through him. So I'm going to, that is not what I want to show you actually. Here we go. So those were fun slides. I have a little bit of an eclectic presentation as well. I'm gonna share with you the perspective on urban farms and urban forests from a sort of a, trying to correct something here. We'll stop that for a moment. From the perspective of a city planner, and my experiences, well, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about some of my experiences with these as both a city planning consultant and as a planning commissioner for several cities in California and Oregon. So how do we plan for urban forests and farms? Well, first we have to overcome something that's been a problem for planning and city development for centuries. That's, we have a dualistic thinking about cities and nature, that they're separate entities and historically and even today are very much segregated in terms of planning and exclusive. But if we look back on if we look back on the way we view cities in the near present, an example is the Viennese artist and city planner Friedensreich Hundertwasser first referred to urban trees as ambassadors of the forest. He recognized that in addition to the aesthetic appeal of seasonal color, motion, sound, scents, and the health benefits of oxygen, noise abatement, and climate regulation, that they also provide a psychological connection to natural forests. This connection with forests also includes recreation and health restoration with techniques such as Shinrin Yoku, which is meditative forest bathing. And this is a photo some of you may recognize of the Tree to Tree Adventure Park in Gaston. If you get a chance, go. It's a hilariously mad good time. But street trees have been sanitized for your convenience. And what I mean by that is they're selected for the ease of maintenance and typically planted about 30 feet apart in tree wells. They're standardized, they're engineered, and largely for public works convenience. If we wish to truly, fully realize the potential of a biodiverse green infrastructure, we will need to replant our green spaces as integrated ecosystems rather than decorative streetscapes. To realize urban forest planning, we will need to shift from a mechanical thinking approach where trees are primarily street furniture to a systems thinking approach, which Harper mentioned with the urban farm, where trees are part of a citywide sustainable ecosystem. At the turn of the last century, Ebenezer Howard envisioned a garden city with the benefits of both town and country. The garden city was an extraordinary shift from millennia of dualistic thinking about the city and nature. In fact, a little off topic, this idea was so powerful that it was translated into languages around the world and used in everything from advertising chocolates to a variety of clothing even and so on. However, cities are still viewed as separate from nature, and this is particularly challenging for Oregon communities where urban growth boundaries segregate urban development from forests and farms. Some of you may be aware of the controversies surrounding the city of Damascus a few years ago on this particular issue. Agriculture, just as nature, has also been historically excluded from the city. Rather than a dualistic approach to separating urbanism from agriculture, planning should consider the spectrum from rural industrial agriculture to urban vertical farms. Systematic urban farming gives the agri-urban spectrum much greater depth. Novel ways of introducing urban agriculture in Oregon include the Tour de Coupes. Some of you may know that. It's a bicycle tour, a walking tour of unique coupes throughout the city, outdoor restaurant herb walls, learning gardens, and a variety of co-op strategies, among others. This photo is of a unique coupe village in Port Angeles, Washington. The spectrum extends agriculture throughout the urban fabric, including animal husbandry, such as the ever popular practice of backyard poultry, farmers markets, green wall and green roof gardens, and ubiquitous edible landscaping. I often ask my students, the Green City students and other courses I teach at the University of Oregon, how far would you have to walk to find food growing in the city? Well, again, some of the students are very familiar with the urban farm, so that doesn't count. That's not fair. So the students are asked to find some other place they could walk to for growing food in the city. Might know a secret place to find mushrooms, or they might know a particular tree that has nuts. But in general, most students are even confounded by the question, why would there be food in the city? Cities spend enormous resources on the care and feeding of street trees. Why not have them return the favor? How far would you have to walk to find food growing in the city? There's a small town in England called Todmorden. Little off topic, my wife is British, born in London, so I have some slides and background items from England. The town is called the Incredible Edible Todmorden. And if you haven't heard of this, please go online and check this out. They've got TED Talks, videos. It's heartwarming. It's amusing. It's an amazing story of a town that reimagined its future and thought of a future with a downtown scape that was completely edible. Their battle cry was originally, no more sticky bushes. I couldn't get my wife June to say that for us, but and they've embarked on this program to make the entire landscape of Todmorden edible. This photograph is actually right in front of the police station in the city of Todmorden. It launched an incredible movement, the Incredible Edible Movement, and a whole new type of vegetable tourism. On a topic that we could probably go on for a long time, and something that was really heartfelt about Harper's presentation about the urban farm was, consider our front yards. I mean, grass turf is a non-native ground cover. In fact, it's an exotic species that loses more water through evapotranspiration than the equivalent surface area of a pond or lake. Why not have an edible front yard that requires less water and provides more visual interest? I have some friends that live on the downtown Portland on the east side that are growing corn in their front yard. So it's probably the most unique front yard landscape in that neighborhood. And as a side note, in the backyard, they have beekeeping. So they raise a few eyebrows when their bees swarm occasionally, but to my knowledge, no one's ever actually been stung there. Introducing food into the urban landscape not only increases resiliency, it dramatically improves the urban experience. The senses of smell and taste are largely excluded from the urban planning and design practice, yet they can be the most profound personal and social experiences. In the urban nature transect, where and how do we plan for balance? Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, launched the environmental movement and refers to a season without birdsong, the result of overused pesticides killing birds such as this red-winged blackbird. Although more than half a century has passed, we still struggle to achieve balance between society, economy, and environment. And on a side note, again, this is one of my wife's illustrations with a watercolor pencil. Animals around the world are becoming urbanized as a response to shrinking and fragmented habitats. We have peregrine falcons in New York. In fact, the largest population of peregrine falcons, concentrated population, is actually in the city of New York. Foxes in London, wild boars in Rome, coyote transit riders in Portland, and many others. And rather than continually responding to urbanized wildlife vectors, we should plan biodiverse urban systems that accommodate a spectrum of species in equilibrium. In a pre-pandemic world, my students were occasionally late to class due to traffic congestion, but wouldn't it have been more meaningful if they were delayed by a herd of elk rather than a horde of cars? If having charismatic megaphone in cities is a bridge or critter crossing too far, how amazing would it be to have seasonal butterflies in the downtown? Integrating urban forests and farms into a comprehensive urban ecosystem will require complex planning and management that will ultimately be enabled by artificially intelligent autonomous systems. As we move toward the city of the fourth industrial revolution, we must plan for sustainable urban ecosystems as well as cyberphysical systems. Dr. Timothy Beatley, who received his master's in urban planning from the University of Oregon, is world-renowned for his work on biophilic cities and his publication, Biophilic Cities, Integrating Nature into Urban Design and Planning. This requires infusing all levels of urban design, from buildings to neighborhoods to entire cities, with scientific information about the natural environments at hand, as well as a sense of how people can and would want to interact with nature. He describes these biophilic cities as being natureful. The infusion of nature into cities will provide extraordinary benefits in biodiversity, heat island mitigation, air filtration, acoustic attenuation, microclimate regulation, recreation, food security, and many others. Imagine a city where more than half of its surface area could be used for biosolar development. This illustration is a rendering of Chicago's goal to be the city of green roofs, and they currently have more than 200. In this animation, we see the infusion of nature as a quantum shift from street furniture to urban forests, from hardscaping to foodscaping, and from mechanical to living systems thinking. As the majority of the human population now lives in cities, we must view them as sustainable ecosystems where the relationship with nature creates a more sustainable, resilient, and regenerative community. It's been a pleasure to share my thoughts on these topics with you, and I hope that all your urban ecology encounters are memorable and meaningful. And I hope we get to talk a little bit about more of this after Eric's finished with his talk as well. Thank you for your time and good humor. think I've stopped share.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Rick and Harper and Peok. That was really, really inspiring to hear Harper and Rick speak. And I am going to speak about Friends of Trees and our work, one small element of the urban forest here in Eugene and Springfield, and talk a little bit about resiliency in urban forestry, our state, and where we might go. I'm going to start sharing the screen also, and hopefully this will work. Friends of Trees is a regional nonprofit community building organization that tries to engage people in urban forestry, mostly physically, and help them learn more about planting, caring for trees, and about the urban forest. Let's see. I have not done a lot of screen sharing, and I'm trying to get this video to share properly. There we go. We have several programs. One is our green space program that plants trees in parks, natural areas, roadsides around here. We're mostly planting on significant roadsides, like here's by the Union Pacific Rail Yard between Northwest Expressway and the rail yard in the lower photo, and in the upper photo between Beltline and Danebo Roosevelt Boulevard out in West Eugene. A lot of our plantings in these areas are just kind of initiating plants and woody plants into an area that doesn't have them. There's only one tree, I believe, in about 8 miles of Northwest Expressway between the expressway and the rail yard. A lot of our planting here are in these little pods that you can see here. They're about 6 to 8 feet in diameter, have 1 to 3 native trees and 5 or 6 native plants. A lot of our work recently has been on adding some of the Kalapuya economy food plants that Harper mentioned earlier. The Kalapuya managed this area for around 7,000 to 9,000 years. We're adding camas, milkweed, Douglas's spirea, and some other plants that are really good for pollinators, as well as food in this area. Our biggest program plants street and yard trees with volunteers around town. We also engage volunteers on structural pruning of small trees along our streets. And the top photo here is a young man who took over watering trees planted alongside Irving Elementary in one of our plantings. And he spent 2 summers taking care of all the watering himself, pretty much with his friends, for the trees. We have events where we care for plantings that we've already done, weeding, mulching, watering. We also have a group of volunteers called Summer Inspectors who check on every tree that we plant each of the first two dry seasons, and provide support for tree recipients for how they're doing weeding, watering, and mulching their trees. So you can see some of that. We do a lot of engagement of volunteers in planting, a lot of volunteer groups. We do a fair amount of educational presentations, tree walks, tours of school campuses with elementary school students to get to know the trees that live on their campus. I'm gonna switch to a different presentation here, and hopefully this will work. And I'm gonna switch what I'm talking about here talk about what would make a sustainable or resilient or locally adapted urban forestry. And first off, by talking about where we actually are, in my perspective, my academic background was in anthropology and particularly archaeology of Oregon and building local food systems. And when the state we're at right now, in my view, is a people who've lost almost all meaningful knowledge, particularly about plants, about horticulture, about our region, about landscape, about using plants, about growing food. And so we really have to start kind of at the beginning, knowing that it'll be generations of work to build a knowledgeable and skilled culture again. And we really have to meet each other where we're at and help each other try and relearn how to live. In my view, we live in a failed lifeway, the industrial capitalist lifeway that is harmful to both people and nature, and try and build a way to live a new lifeway that takes care of people and nature. Our city is currently organized really to maximize the throughput or the production of money, and to make it safe for cars. A world organized kind of around cars, utilities, and our urban forest is, I'd say, many, if not most, of our trees are the wrong trees in the wrong place. As Rick and Harper both referenced, 15 to 20% of our city is lawn, almost all of which is not used. And instead of just being left, we rumble machines over it, causing all kinds of harm. A lot of it is irrigated unnecessarily. We just waste water like crazy. There's a lot of impervious surfaces, and a lot of the landscape is also bark and mulch and ornamental trees. And I guess I would say that the biggest thing that I think we need to do is to try and move from a focus on a really shallow aesthetics that can be seen as kind of a selfish approach to life, to trying to focus on trees that will be used for fiber, medicine, wood, and particularly thinking about making our urban forests serve not us, serve not humans, and how we do that. And so we have a urban forest that really leads to helping people in nature and take care of people in nature. And there's a lot of ways to get there. I think we need to really think about the habitat values of the plants that we plant, and try and help out what we've hurt really badly, which are particularly native pollinators, but almost all invertebrates. And really trying to help, particularly our native bumblebees can use a lot of help. And we can do that with many of the trees we plant. I think starting to think of our urban forest as a working forest, a forest that we're planting and harvesting all the time, and trying to avoid the extremist preservationist views of trees will lead us to be more connected with trees and use them in our economy and in our physical work for all kinds of things. Every tree in the city has multiple uses, and almost none of them are being used for much more than firewood. So moving in that direction is a great way. Almost all trees have different uses. Like I've said, many have food uses that, for instance, our oaks, there's an enormous amount of food that goes down into our gutters and melts into the soil, which is fine, but that we could be using in our trees from hawthorns, dogwoods, oaks, golden rain trees, many other trees. We also, currently we put some emphasis on planting trees for ecological services, particularly stormwater, cleaning our air and water and cooling, but there's a lot more we can do in this way. And another thing is really focusing on trees that are adapted to our climate and soils. That is summer rainfall, summer drought adapted trees. Currently, almost all the trees in our urban forests, the vast majority of them are from summer rainfall areas that really aren't very suited to our climate and soils. So as we redesign cities, trying to remove more hardscape, we can burying power lines would allow us almost half of our street trees in our city could be larger trees and would make a huge difference. We'd have to really, really look at the American Disabilities Act and consider, you know, could we remove half of all our sidewalks in the city? And is it okay to have really good passage on one side of the street, but not another? I think we need to make some hard, ask some hard questions and talk about some of these things. We need to think about moving our large trees from the planting strips along the street to that front yard area. All that area that's in lawn, both in front and back yards, much of it, we do need some lawns for small children and for playing and things like that. I'd say 98% isn't used for those uses currently and should be moved towards gardens and trees. So a lot large trees, people are really resistant to having anything but lawn or bark mulch in that front yard area. But there's so much more room for roots in the area between the sidewalk and the house than there is in the area that has utility trenches, is severely compacted, and is in conflict with roads and sidewalks, the area where we currently emphasize planting our trees. Public right-of-ways are about 25% of our cities, 75% is private. Almost all funding for tree planting goes to the public side, and there's almost none on the private side. That's the area we really want to grow and find funding to help people with planting trees and gardens on that private side. Some of the most important changes I think that we can make to build a more resilient urban forestry fall in three kind of areas: the consumer side, the production side, and the cultural side. And on the production side, we need to develop good local nurseries that supply us with what we need. Street trees are one of the largest growing areas in the world, is between Salem and Portland. In our own area, we have a couple nurseries that grow trees. Another thing is we need organic tree nurseries. As far as I have never heard of a nursery that grows street trees that's organic, or that even really cares about the pesticides that they use, other than the effect on themselves and their cost, but the effect on the landscape. And the reason for that is that we don't care. Everything is driven by consumer spending, and consumers care about food that they eat, but not other plants that are grown in our landscape currently. And so we need to change that conversation to drive demand for better practices in the nursery trade. The nursery trade is the most toxic part of agriculture. It's the number one industry in Oregon, nursery industry, right above cattle and calves. It's the most toxic industry, and it needs to change. We also really need, on that production side, to start to think about intra-specific diversity rather than just inter-specific diversity. So instead of planting largely clones and highly bred patented life forms for trees, we need to think about planting open pollinated trees that are selected for form and disease resistance and structure, but are not patented. We need to have nurseries that focus more on bare root rather than the soil mining that a lot of nurseries do, and really focus on well-provenant seed stock. Which is something that now if you ask for the provenance of trees from a nursery person, they'll often just laugh at you. So we really also need to reintegrate hunter-gatherer life skills as well as horticultural life skills into the production side. I think we should be starting to be eating geese and nutria in our cities and reintegrating camas and other food plants and make them important part of our cities. On the consumer side, we need to have just the opposite of the production side. We need to have a low cost, local supply of locally adapted woody plants. And we need to support all different folks who are growing trees, from contractors, landscapers, tree companies, nonprofits, municipalities, all the different areas. And we need a lot of educational support to address the complete lack of knowledge and skills among our populace. So we need a stronger extension service. We need more programs like Harper's and more teachers like Rick and more knowledge in every area from pre-K to college. We should be teaching those hunter-gatherer and horticultural life skills. On the cultural side, my hope and what Friends of Trees will contribute to and what I think so many people are working on now, we kind of reached the bottom by the 70s, and by then there was a significant movement of regrowing these skills, regrowing the knowledge and the kind of things that we need to build a healthy culture that takes care of people in nature. But really the goal is to build a culture of people that have the skill and the knowledge, and they can afford to care for nature in our area and to care and grow our urban forest.